Welcome to Extreme Genes, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And you have found us, America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. My name is Fisher. I am the Radio Root Sleuth on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And this week, it's a couple of classic interviews on the best of Extreme Genes as we go back a couple of years to talk, first of all, to a woman who found out that she was actually sold at birth to her adoptive family. What was the story surrounding that? How much was she worth? And how did it all work out? And has she found her birth family yet? We'll get the entire story straight from the mouth of Heather Leathergood, who has lived it. That'll be in about 8 minutes. And then later on the show, a woman who went to work on tracing her lineage and found a connection to a little girl in the Old West who met a horrible demise, and how that story developed into a whole other thing, including the discovery of her gravesite and what she's done with that. You'll want to catch my visit with Marcia Nolan Bergman coming up later on in the show. It's an incredible story. Hopefully now that summer is here, you're making some incredible discoveries, and these stories will inspire you just a little bit. Let's go to Boston and find out what's happening with David Allen Lambert, the chief genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org. Hello, David.
Greetings from Beantown, Fish. How are you?
You know, I am doing so well. I've already had so many amazing discoveries this year. For instance, just recently found out that a third cousin to my dad had married a guy named William Deegan in New York City back at the beginning of the last century. Turns out William Deegan was Major Deegan. Major William Deegan. The Major Deegan Expressway that goes past Yankee Stadium.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think as a New York baseball fan, you must appreciate that greatly.
I did appreciate that greatly. I thought that was kind of a strange find. But, you know, every year has something new that's kind of unique.
Just 2 days ago, I found the adoption from my wife's great-great-grandfather in Quebec and never had found that before. And turn out they're not French-Canadian after all. They're Irish.
Who knew? And you've been looking for, what, 30 years?
About 25.
25? Not bad. That's a great find. So this is something that's disturbing me. There's this story out about this study they did of college grads, 25 to 34 years old. Hmm. And it turns out that 10% of them believe that Judge Judy sits on the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah, I saw the same story. I think it's the same one that talks that only 60% of the college students say that Thomas Jefferson actually was the father of the Constitution.
No, that was the Declaration.
And, you know, the other, I think another statistic said something about 20% of the students couldn't identify what the direct effect of the Emancipation Proclamation was.
Ooh, that's a little disturbing.
I hope we don't have to poll the listeners, that all of our listeners know that that was the end of slavery.
Yeah, I know they all know that. You know, this is another reason why you want to get your kids involved in family history, because once they begin to identify and understand their connections back to these times, history has a greater meaning to them, and things like this will not be lost to your kids.
Well, you know, you mentioned things about getting lost. One of my first family history news stories for you is some sad and scary news out in Madison, Wisconsin, that all those earthen burial mounds of the Native Americans, shaped like bears and deer and birds and people, et cetera, are in jeopardy now.
Really?
There's actually a bill, Fish, that's before the legislature to actually cause it to perhaps be built upon. They could be dug into, and pot hunters, which is a term we use in archaeology, could go in there, be looking for burial remains and grave goods. I would hate to think that 500 years from now, the colonial graveyards of our ancestors are going to be besieged by metal detectors or pot hunters. You know,
wow.
It's scat.
It's really, you know, not only a horrible thing for those affected, obviously the Native Americans, they're Americans, first and foremost. What are these people thinking? I mean, that's insane.
First Americans. Well, in the idea of preservation, I'm happy to announce that NEHCS, in conjunction with the Congregational Library, the Archives, the Phillips Library of the Peabody Essex Museum, and the Connecticut Conference of the United Church of Christ, have received a grant of over $200,000 to help preserve and digitize 28,000 pages of church records, from diaries, pastoral records, dating from 1641 to the mid-1800s. That's exciting, because a lot of vital records are available online, but a lot of the details of the church records of colonial New England are not.
Right, and that really was the vital record archive of New England.
It absolutely was. So hopefully there's some new discoveries waiting to be found in this 28,000 pages that are being worked on right now. So that's exciting, and you know, sometimes your discoveries don't have to be in archives. They can be on eBay. We all have a black sheep in the family, and myself not excluded, and it's scary to think that I could search for a particular relative on eBay for his or her mugshot. I have seen countless, dozens upon dozens of from 19th century mugshots right down to ones that were taken in the 50s and 60s that are basically deacquisition from police departments like Scranton, Pennsylvania. If any of the listeners have family from there and have a black sheep in the family, go on eBay. I've seen dozens of pictures right now. In technology, there's a company called Livestream that is releasing this month something called Movie, M-O-V-I, and what it will do is it's a camera that you can shoot from multiple angles. So say, for instance, you have a family reunion and you want to catch all those cousins and the kids running around or get multiple people being interviewed at the same time, this little device for about $200 or less will allow you to do that. And that's brought to you by Livestream. Of course, NEHDS every week offers a free guest user database, and this is the final week of our January release for the three big databases that we offer just to become a guest user of AmericanAncestors.org, and that includes Massachusetts vital records from 1841 to 1910, New Hampshire vital records to 1937, and Vermont vital records from the earliest time right through 2008. From NEHDS for our listeners, and signing off from Beantown, see you in a couple of weeks.
It is the best of Extreme Genes, America's family history show on ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And coming up, you'll hear a conversation I had with a woman a couple of years ago who not only was adopted, she learned she had been sold at birth.
Her name is Heather Livergood. She's in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Hi, Heather. Welcome to the show.
How are you today?
Awesome. You know, it is so nice to have you on. There are many people who love to research their past, as you've certainly done. And it's not unusual to have blocks back there because of adoptions or illegitimacies, all kinds of challenges in our research. But typically, that's something we find from somebody way back. It's not us ourselves. And that was the case, though, for you. You didn't know who your mother was, your father was, your birth parents. You've had a lifetime of not knowing about that. How has that affected your life?
Well, you know, I think the question is who do I look like and where do I come from? And I wanted to know my roots. Even though I came from a great home, those are just questions that always bugged me. My adopted mom died when I was 3, and my dad died when I was 34. So that's when I started looking really seriously. When I was pregnant, I thought, oh my gosh, I wonder what this baby's going to look like. And so that's when I got my birth certificate. You could get it in Montana then if you were over 18, the sealed birth certificate, and that's what I did.
How long have you been doing this?
Oh, I've been looking probably close to 40 years.
Wow. And you had recent success, and we do want to get into that, but I think one of the most interesting things I've ever seen was the headline of this story that was running in your area that said you were sold as a baby in Butte, Montana. I've never run into that one before. How much were you sold for? What were you worth there, by the way, Heather?
Well, I was worth $100, and I think I gave him $100 worth. But, you know, back in the 40s, that was a lot of money. My dad at the time, and I think I remember, and of course I was probably 10 or 12 then, but we sold donuts for a nickel. So probably when I was born, I bet he was selling donuts probably for a couple cents apiece. So even at a nickel, my dad would have had to sell 2,000 donuts. And that's a lot of donuts.
To get the baby. Let's talk about that. If somebody is being sold, that must mean there's a seller somewhere. Who was the seller? What was the circumstance behind this that you've learned in your research?
Well, the seller was a lady by the name of Gertrude Buchanan, and she wasn't a doctor, but she thought she was. Her husband passed away, and she took over his business. She was a chiropractor. So she sold babies. She did abortions. She had some of her patients pass away. She went to court. She was never brought up on any charges because I think she had the scoop on everyone in the city of Butte. So she sold babies for, I have to think now, for 20 years.
Now, as an abortionist, did this mean that some of the babies were born alive and maybe the mothers didn't know it and then she took them and sold them?
Well, she actually, some of the mothers passed away. And some of the babies, she did tell the mothers that the babies died, and then she sold them.
Oh, my gosh. And you found out about this through what research?
You know, my dad always told me where he got me from. My mom and dad, my adopted mom and dad, they had adopted an older brother through the legal channels, and my mom wanted a girl, and my dad said babies were very hard to find. And, of course, he was born and raised in Butte, so he knew everyone, and he is the one that found this Buchanan. And that's how they got me. But I was just glad I wasn't placed with her, because we talked to one of the children she kept, and she said all she can remember from Buchanan is her beating her.
Oh.
So she was not a nice lady.
No, clearly not. And from this situation, you wound up in your adoptive family, and obviously it worked out very well for you, despite the fact you lost your adoptive mother at three.
Correct.
You had a great dad and a great upbringing. And now you wanted to fill this hole in your life, this where do I come from thing, I think, that is so fundamental and universal to all of mankind. And off to work you went. And you obviously came up with quite a bit of information you developed. What did you know about your birth mother and your birth father?
I knew about my birth mom, how old she was when I was born, and that another sibling was also born to her. And my dad did tell me that I was born in a motel room. When he picked me up, he said, there was a little boy outside. He says, I don't know if he's your full brother or half brother, but you have a brother out there. And that has always stuck with me, that I knew I had a brother, whether it was a half sibling or a full sibling. Now, the man that was with my birth mom, my dad at the time, he said, I do not believe that man that was with your mom was your father.
All right. So it's a little complicated, and you had to work through this. Obviously, 30, 40 years ago when you started this search, there weren't the tools that we have available today. What kind of records did you use when you started?
I just went off that birth certificate, and come to find out, I don't even know if the birth dad's name on there is correct. And the only name I had for my mother was her first name, which was Violet. And she did not have a last name or a maiden name on that birth certificate. So I was actually looking for the dad's name.
All right, so let's go through the process. Obviously, it was a stop-and-go thing. You'd probably go for many years without finding anything new.
That's right.
And ultimately, we came across the holy grail of genealogical research these last 10, 15 years, and that's DNA and digitized newspapers. Were you able to use both of those?
I actually did submit my DNA. If it wasn't for DNA, I don't think I would have ever found her, because I wasn't even looking in the right spot.
Was she still living?
No, she was not.
All right. And so you did the DNA, you did a test, and you posted it generally out there to see if there were any matches in the databases?
Well, it comes back once you put your DNA, it gives you a list of matches. So at that point, I just started from the top. I kept writing, and I finally hit a third cousin. And bless her heart, she took upon herself, and she is the one that did all the research for me, and it took her 5 months to nail down the family.
Wow. What type of research did she do to find how you guys tied together?
Well, she took all the people that we were related to, and it was a process of elimination as a common name that kept coming through.
Okay.
And then also, I had about approximate age of a boy. Once she looked at one family, she'd see if they have children and look at the ages of the boy. So as you can see, that is a long process to go through families, look at their siblings, and then the ages.
But you had the name Violet.
I did have the name Violet, but guess what? Violet was a very popular name in that time.
That's true, but you're looking for a Violet in a certain time period, in a certain family line with an older child, an older
Correct.
Boy. So there were a lot of things to help you narrow it down. Is that how it ultimately came about?
Yes, and that is what came about.
And so she kind of narrowed it down to this family, and that meant now you were in a position where you could actually reach out and see if somebody might respond.
That's correct. So once we figured out she had the correct family, the boy fit in right, the mother's name was Violet, and I also had how old she was when I was born,
okay.
And her birth date fit in perfect.
So was she able to track down any living members of this core family for you then?
Yes, she tracked down the brother. He was alive.
The older brother.
And he had another brother.
Is that right?
I wrote to this Bob Sandberg, and I wrote a letter to him telling him I was adoptive. I said, well, you know, I'm just looking for relatives. I'm trying to find some roots, and would you do a DNA test? And he agreed.
Wow.
Well, a couple weeks went by, and I never heard. And so I finally tried to call him, and I never could get a hold of him. And then he left me a message and said he decided not to do the DNA test, which I was devastated because I thought, well, what am I going to do now?
Right.
So I called him back. I left him a message. I said, the reason I want you to do a DNA test is because I think your mother is my mother. Well, that got his attention.
Oh, yeah.
So, of course, he's still skeptical. We've had articles in People magazine and in the local paper. So I sent him those articles just so he knew I was very upfront at this point.
Sure.
So after he got the newspaper clippings, he sent the DNA test in. And when we got that test back, we were 99% close relation.
Wow. How did he take that?
You know, bless his heart, they took it quite well that they had a sister. He said he was disappointed in his mom that she would do that. Mm. And I told him I don't want them to think that way because you don't know the circumstances
No.
that she was in.
No.
And I didn't want them thinking less of their mother.
Absolutely. We're never going to understand all the things that were going on with our people back in the day and what the reasons were. And it's just what it is.
It is what it is. And that's what I told him. Just be thankful that I have found you. And we'll probably never know the reasons, but you know, his dad and my birth mother, they stayed together. They had another child that's a year and a half younger than me. It was another boy. I mean, I guess I'm surprised that they stay married, but you know as well as I do, people in those days did not get divorced.
Not very easily. That's right.
No.
Well, Heather, tell us about now your relationship with this older brother and I guess a younger one as well. What's going on with that? Have you met?
Yes, we flew down in September, my husband and I, and we met both of the brothers, and we met one of the brothers. He has four kids, and we met three of the four kids, and they took us out, and we had a picnic out in the woods, and you know, it went very well. I didn't really know what to expect. After all these years, you're meeting blood relatives, but you're also meeting strangers.
That's right. Did you see resemblance?
No, not very much. Maybe more towards the younger brother. They're very tall. They're like 6'1 and 6'3, and I'm 5'4.
Oh. You never know, do you?
No, but you know, we always wondered, because our youngest daughter is 5'10, and we always wondered where she got her height. So now we know.
Unbelievable. She's Heather Livergood from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. She was sold as a baby for $100 and has found her birth family. Heather, thanks so much for sharing your story. It's unbelievable.
Well, and thank you for calling. And, you know, I hope it gives hopes to other people that are looking. I would strongly say put your DNA and start searching.
Good luck to you. Thanks so much,
right.
Heather.
You betcha. And you have a good day.
Hey, it's the Best of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And coming up next, we're going to talk to a Midwest woman named Marcia Nolan Bergman, who discovered that she had an interesting tie to a very strange Old West case.
Hi, Marcia. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Glad to be here.
I am so excited. I was just, you know, reading your story about how you traced down, you were working on a DAR application. And by the way, anytime you go to join a lineage society like that or the Mayflower Society, it's a lot of work, isn't it? A lot of detail.
It really is. And you need a lot of proofs.
A lot of proofs. And as a result of that, you ran across a story of a little girl from your neck of the woods named Sarah Catherine Nolan, and she was, 9 years old back in 1867. Tell the story a little bit.
Okay. When I ran into this story in the Jesse James book by William Settle, it just called her a little girl. And later on, I came across some other accounts of this, and they said it was Miss Nolan or Dr. Nolan's daughter. Well, since I was in Nolan, then that piqued my interest. Sarah was, like you said, about 9 years old, and there had been a bank robbery at Richmond, Missouri, and they were looking for the outlaws that were involved in that bank robbery on May 23rd, 1867. And they came by the farm where Sarah was staying, and it was a blinding rainstorm, and they didn't know how to get to the Evans farm, which is where they thought one of the outlaws, Payne Jones, was hiding. So they stopped, either she volunteered or for some reason the family allowed her to go because she said she could take them to the farm. So she was with them in this blinding rainstorm, got them to where they needed to be, but unfortunately Payne Jones heard them coming or something, and he fired a shot from his shotgun, and he killed a deputy, and it said fatally wounded Sarah. So I don't think she died immediately. She was shot as well.
Now, this Payne Jones was connected with the James Gang, right?
That's correct.
It sounds like they almost had separate little groups that went out, because the story says that he actually was the ringleader for a bank robbery, but it doesn't mention the James brothers being involved.
No, it doesn't, and it also doesn't mention the Youngers either, and the Youngers said they had alibis, so neither the James or Youngers was, but these were some people who had evidently been with them at other times.
So you found the story, and now you recognize the potential that this girl might be related to you because of the local name of Noland, N-O-L-A-N-D. And what is the relationship? How far back are you tied? Do you know?
Well, she is my second cousin once removed.
Okay.
So it's really not that far back.
No.
She was my dad's second cousin.
Really? Your dad's second cousin?
Mm-hmm. And there were 30 years difference in their ages because my father was born. My father was born 30 years after she was born.
I see. In the 1880s?
He was born in 1887.
Okay. Got it. That kind of probably put a halt to your work on the DAR application for a while. Because
well, I had
it's a
done
great
a lot
tale.
Of it already, so I was in pretty good shape. And I kind of went off on, you know, another area with this. And it took a long, long time because that was 20 years ago, and we only found the grave about last year.
Well, now, talk about that. How did you locate the grave?
Well, a friend of mine knew I was looking for this little girl, and she was studying the Woodlawn Cemetery, which is a historic cemetery in Independence. And she came across this Nolan girl who was buried with the Moon family. And she called me and said, "What's this Nolan girl doing buried with the Moons?" And we had never heard that before. And it turned out that they were her maternal grandparents. She had been buried on a farm with them, and then they moved the bodies later to Woodlawn Cemetery.
And her grave then was just a stone, but no name on it.
Well, there was no stone. Hers had been broken off. It was just there was cement, and a little bit of the marker was there to tell it was a white marble one, and it was broken off, so there was no information on it at all. But fortunately, there was a record of the cemetery her being buried there.
Ah, and so that's when you found out where she was, right there in the neighborhood, and she didn't have a marker. So now you went to work.
Mm-hmm. And I had the help of a lot of friends, and one in particular, the one who had found the grave, did a lot of research for me and helped me out with it and really encouraged me because she thought, well, we should do a marker or something, and I thought that would be a good idea, too, because it had been broken off.
Well, and it's such a sad story. I mean, can you imagine the parents, how they had to have felt about letting her go?
And, well, yes, and then another thing is Payne Jones may very well have known the Nolans because, you know, it was a close-knit Independence town, and it's likely he even knew her dad maybe even. So, I mean, and then to have that happen, I'm sure it was a real tragedy. And I could find no information on her funeral or obituary or anything. So I never did find anything like that.
Now, have all the Independence newspapers or regional newspapers been digitized yet?
I think some of them have, and we did a lot of searching for them and even went to other newspapers in close-by towns, but we never found an obituary about that. Now, the deputy that was killed, there was a little notice about his funeral services, and that was all that was there about him.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, a story like that today would garner all kinds of attention.
Sure it would have. Mm-hmm.
And Independence is so full of history. In fact, I went there once and stopped by Harry Truman's place, and he wasn't home.
I saw him several times. I didn't actually meet him, but I ran into him one time when he and Bess were up on the square, and she was shopping for a dress. And that was common back then, and we saw him at the grocery store. So, I mean, he literally just walked around town and did the same thing everybody else did, and it was quite common to see him. And he also was related to the Nolans.
Oh, was that right? In
yes.
what way?
I'm not. I think he was. He had a relative, James Noland, who would have been the brother of my third great grandfather, Ledstone, who is the one I went into the DAR on.
Okay, he was a Revolutionary soldier, and you're saying that Harry Truman descended from him as well?
From the brother.
From the brother. Okay, mm-hmm. So he's a distant cousin, also. Well, isn't that interesting? I think every area where families have been there for some time, there's a lot more close relations than anybody ever knows. And maybe many people who live on your same street or you went to school with or worked with are relatives, and you have no idea.
Right. And they're related somehow, and you just kind of find that out.
So let's go through the tombstone. You got the tombstone. How did you get it funded through various people, or did you do it all yourself, or how did that work?
I pretty much did that one myself. I had helped on another one. Sarah had some cousins that were killed down in Kentucky, and I had worked on that one, and a group from several different states went together and purchased that one, and they were killed during the Civil War, so I had been involved with that one, but on this one, it was pretty much my own project, so it was something I really wanted to do.
Well, and I think it's so worthy. Can you share with us what the inscription says?
It pretty much tells her story and basically just says that she was shot and killed while with the posse that was after Payne Jones. And that's basically what it says. And then I had the Nolan family motto put on the other side, which is one heart, one way. And I always liked that saying, and that's part of that's the Nolan motto. And they were from Ireland.
Well, that's a great story, Marcia, and thanks for all your time and sharing it with us. And good luck in your pursuits.
Thank you very much.
It's the Best of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And coming up next, as always, we'll talk to Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com.
Tom, you were having such a good time at Roots Tech, and it's fun. We've got stories that go on for weeks from what happened over just a few days because people were bringing things to your booth and asking for advice on some of these items. But the one thing that really lit you up that I noticed, what was it, a 19th century selfie?
Oh, yeah, it was like late 18, early 1900s. Oh, I wanted it so bad.
Now, have you ever seen anything like that before?
Never, never.
And explain what this was, because I think when we talk about selfie, most people picture a long stick and a little modern camera there and a remote control and the whole thing. But obviously back then, that wasn't the case. Who was the person? How old? How did they set this thing up in those times?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. In fact, one of the things that made it so cool to me is I remember back when I started my career in photography back in junior high school, I remember we had this big mirror when you walked in the front door, and I did the same thing. It was before I had Nikons. I just had an old Petroflex. I had the tripod set up, smiling in the mirror, and pull a little button. And it's like flashback 100 years earlier, and here's this kid wearing the type of clothes they wore back in those days, the tie. He had his tripod set up. He had a little brownie camera on top of it.
Now, you saw that in a picture?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because what he's doing is he has his camera, and he's looking into the mirror.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So this mirror is on, I don't know what they used to call them back then, kind of like a bureau, because you could see the drawers,
sure.
You could see the sides, because it was back far enough that he not only got the mirror, he got part of the surroundings of it. And he's just standing there with his little tie on and his little period clothing, and just standing there smiling and took this picture. And it's so cool. And the thing that makes it so cool is it's not just a selfie, but you can see it's not a fake selfie.
Right.
Because you can see the things on the outside, the old bureau that it's sitting on, the handcrafting around the mirror. And that was a cool thing. I saw this and I loved it.
So that's a mirror image, though, of himself,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Which you could reverse and flip if you wanted to.
Exactly. So it was a selfie in the old-fashioned ways, because in the old days, you didn't even have timers on your camera. So you couldn't run and get in the picture. You had to have somebody else do it. So it truly was a selfie. Somebody took a picture of him, and it was so cool. But then the one downside of the picture had a lot of spots on it, just from being old and wear and tear. And the lady that brought it in told me the history that I believe – she said it was like an uncle or a grandfather.
So it was a relative.
Right. It was definitely a relative. And she told me a little bit about him. And then this guy actually got into photography. There's people that every once in a while do these selfie contests. Send in your best selfie and they give away prizes and such. And I told her, I said, you need to make a copy of this and send it in because I guarantee this is going to be the oldest selfie anybody's ever seen.
It's a winner.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. But I wanted it so bad. Oh, it was
what
awesome.
Do you think something like that would be worth? Are you a collector? Do you collect photographs?
No, I don't collect stuff like that. I mostly just look for family things that are related. And to me, if I saw it on eBay, happened to run across and it was $100, I would have bought it without even thinking about it because it was so special to me.
Sure.
So I tried to bribe the lady. I said, give me all your pictures. Let me scan them for you. And I'm not even going to charge you. I just want to have permission to keep one of these pictures and be able to use it in our store because it's so cool.
And did she agree?
Oh, yeah. Oh, she's totally on board for it.
So what are you having to do to fix it?
Okay, so what we'll do first is we'll scan it at a really high DPI. And since it is a black and white, we're still going to scan it in color like we talked about last week because it gives you more information. Most of the spots on are about the size, a little bit bigger than a pencil lead, so they're not huge. And so we go into Photoshop, which is a great program to do editing. Once we get all these things done, it'll look like the guy just took the picture and it'll look awesome.
Well, isn't that great? And Photoshop Elements, too, a cheaper version with all those same tools on it for anybody.
You don't have to get the full-blown Photoshop like you mentioned. If you've got Elements, which comes free with a lot of scanners, you'll be able to rock and roll with that just fine.
All right. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth. And Tom, recently, of course, we were both at the Roots Tech Conference in Salt Lake City, Utah. And you had a lot of people bringing things to your booth for evaluation, for restoration and recovery. And talk about some of those other items that you saw.
Oh. Exactly. And the thing is, some people don't want to give up their stuff. Even though they flew in, they don't want to leave it. And I understand that. So one thing that you need to do, too, if you're in this situation where you don't want to do it yourself and you don't want to ship it, you want to fly it in, I'm sure there's people in your area that can help you with this. And one thing you need to really do is look outside the box. If you just want to go to a transfer place and you don't think, well, you know, they're not really into photos. They don't know what they're doing. Go to places that do billboards. Go to advertising companies or good references. And they might be able to tell you, oh, yeah, there's a color correction place that does billboards. And take it to them and say, hey, here's what I need done. And they can usually scan it for you right while you're there because they have their equipment set up always to do things like that. Scan it. You can take the photo back with you, and they can do it for you.
They could take a little tiny photo and blow it up to billboard size.
Oh, absolutely. So these people definitely know what they're doing.
Right.
And if you still don't want to leave it, that's fine. Just have them scan it. And even if they say, hey, we don't do photo restoration, but we can scan it for you at a gazillion DPI, then that's fine. Have them put it on your thumb drive or a disc. Take it home. You can email it to us or anybody and get a quote. And the thing is, if you email it to us and ask us for a quote, you don't have to have us do it. You can just say, okay, this is what it would cost, and then take it to somebody local. And if they're in the same ballpark, you know they're being fair with you.
Right.
So we're just more there to kind of help you out. We had this one person brought us a photo that was torn.
Right in half, huh?
Yeah, tore right in half. So half the face was missing. However, we're like a detective. We need to get as much information as we can, which we kind of alluded to last week.
So part of it was missing. It wasn't two halves.
Oh, exactly. A whole part of the guy's face was missing. Kind of like the thumbprint we talked about last week, but not as severe. Because if you have half a person's face, you know they're not asymmetrical. So you can kind of take things and kind of know what you're supposed to do. But anything you can give to us, like type of clothing it was, other photos, even if they're younger or older, it helps our artists see, okay, this was when he was 8 years old. Here's a picture of him when he was 12. Based on that, I can kind of do these things to fix the photo. So be like a detective. Get us any information you can. If it's a color photo that's faded, let us know, oh, yeah, so-and-so used to wear this color. They had this. This is what their eye color was. So we can make sure we get everything right. So your little sister that had green eyes, we don't make them blue or brown.
Right, right.
We want to be as authentic as we can. So bring us this information. Even if it's a black and white photo, get us that information because you think, well, it's black and white. Why do I need to know eye color? Well, in grayscale, blue eyes, brown eyes, and green eyes are going to be different shades of grayscale.
Hmm.
So if you want to be authentic, get us as much information as you can so we as a detective can recreate this picture and make everybody look right. Also, they knew there was supposed to be somebody else in that picture that wasn't there because that half was torn and nobody knew where it was. So if you can get us a picture of that person close as you can to that age, we can make a new family portrait and put that person in.
That's incredible.
Oh, it's amazing what technology will do now. We've even had people bring us photos that had outlaws, like ex-in-laws. They were such a bad situation, they wanted us to take them out.
I've done that.
Oh, you have to. And we can take people out, even if they're front and blocking people, we can remove them, then rebuild people's shoulders or arms or hands or whatever to make it look like they were never there. And as we just mentioned, we can take people and put them in. We've had people that had lost a child that was really, really young, and they still wanted the person to be in there. And so we can either put them in at the age that they became deceased, or if they passed away when they were 14, when this picture was taken, when they would have turned 16, We can put them in as a 14-year-old or even kind of age them and make
really?
Them look like 60.
You can
oh,
do
yeah.
aging.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, boy. Great stuff as always, Tom. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be here again.
Hey, that's it for this week. It was great revisiting these classic interviews with Heather Leathergood talking about how she was sold as a baby and Marcia Nolan Bergman talking about the Old West tale she tied into in her research. Catch the podcast if you missed any of it at iTunes, iHeartRadio, and ExtremeGenes.com. Take care. We'll talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.